So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm senior editor Devendra Hardawar.
I'm reviews editor Sherlyn Lowe.
We are here a couple days after Earth Day, which was celebrated this week, and we had a couple stories here at Engadget about that. Some green apps to celebrate Earth Day indoors and ways to live stream the majesty of nature from your couch. But I thought what was really interesting would be to dive into something Microsoft announced last week, and that is their planetary computer. Which is
what?
It's a crazy name for something that sounds really interesting. So we're going to get more into that soon. As always, if you're enjoying the show, please subscribe to the Engadget Podcast on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Drop us a review, especially in iTunes. That's super helpful. And if you have any questions, leave us an email at podcast@engadget.com. So Sherlyn, when I say planetary computer, what do you think?
Man, what do
you imagine in your eyes?
I imagine... In my brain, I see Tony Stark, I see holograms, I see spinning, revolving things, like orbiting around a central, like, computing node.
Sounds about
something
right.
Something like that. Yeah, really? Oh, wow, okay.
I don't know. Well, so...
I'm an inventor.
It's a great name, but it doesn't... I feel like Microsoft didn't do a great job of explaining what they actually meant by it. So, last week they announced this thing, basically a push towards new environmental initiatives. This was an idea that's kind of an evolution of something Microsoft started several years ago, their AI for Good initiative. Mm-hmm. And that was a plan to, like, bring AI tools to a lot of organizations and, like, you know, people around the world who are trying to do things like environmental conservation. So I had a lot of questions about this, so I pinged Microsoft and we got to chat with Lucas Joppa, their new chief environmental officer. That's a really interesting title. Like, he is a guy. He's the guy in charge of all their environmental work. As he explains it, it's basically this initiative for Microsoft to, first of all, start tracking information of everything happening on the planet. Mm-hmm. So, like, the tides of, like, a random lake or something, you know, in Africa. The way a forest is growing in South America. Like, all this information... It's a way of collecting it and putting it on a unified platform. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know, Windows Earth, you know, or something. Windows Gaia, which sounds kind of crazy.
Good Lord. He does
a better job of explaining it than me. And I think we had a really good conversation. So, take a listen. Could you introduce yourself and your role at Microsoft?
My name is Lucas Joppa. I'm the Chief Environmental Officer at Microsoft, and I oversee sustainability across our global operations.
Thanks so much for taking time to chat with us, Lucas. I wanted to follow up with Microsoft about the announcement last week where you were talking about your new environmental initiatives and also this idea of a planetary computer. And it's a really cool name. It's a cool concept, but we're all also a little confused in terms of, like, what that actually means. Could you clarify that? What is a planetary computer?
Planetary computer, in our minds, is a platform, a new kind of computing platform that brings together all of the globally available environmental data and puts that side by side with some of the most advanced machine learning algorithms on a common computing infrastructure that allows us to, for the first time, include space and time as first-class data citizens in this information age that we all live in today. It's a platform that is intended to accelerate our ability to monitor, model, and then ultimately manage Earth's natural systems to ask questions like, where are the world's forests? Where are the world's wetlands? How fast are they changing? And hopefully... what are the sorts of benefits that we are gaining from those ecosystems? What are the services that those ecosystems provision to people? And these are really big data challenges.
It seems like, yeah, the biggest data, outside of like astronomical data, it seems like a huge amount of information you're talking about here.
It's an incredible amount of information. It's a problem that I believe the modern cloud platform approach to computing is uniquely positioned to help solve. I had the misfortune of coming up in my career right when we were really starting to do large-scale global computation, but without the large-scale global computing platforms.
Right, right.
And, you know, it was one of the things that drew me to Microsoft in the very beginning was just thinking, when I was running, you know, trying to analyze a planet's worth of satellite imagery to understand if protected areas are actually protecting, for instance, and just thinking, there has got to be a better way.
Because you're just basically just staring at satellite images. Is that like the way of doing things right now? Or is there a computer like modeling we were doing already?
There's, you know, there's always been people is, you know, there's always been people trying to look down from above to understand, you know, where things are and what things are where. You know, we've had people working in national labs and more and writing, first of all, going through and, you know, hand annotating these things and then starting to build models. But our ambitions, just like in so many other things in life, our ambitions keep growing faster than our technology. And so, you know, we were able to do that. And then we said, well, oh, what if we could do that not just for the county, but for the state and for the country and then for the world, and not just for the world once, but for the world every year, and not every year, but every day. And we wanted to keep doing all of this. And the computing that's required to crunch through all of those data sets that are coming in is incredible. Because remember, these are interesting types of categories of problems, because oftentimes a question somebody wants to ask is one that is extreme, where the answer is extremely rare, but the data that needs to be perused is vast. So for instance, if you said, find me all of the wildfires happening on Earth right now.
In real time.
In real time. There's not that many. Well, I mean, unfortunately, there's too many. But, you know, relative to the number of square meters of Earth, there's not that many. But to find them all, you have to look through every square meter of Earth. And that requires, A, data that allows you to extract that information, both from the global scale, but also ground truth data that allows you to train an algorithm to learn that, and computing processes that are fast enough and scalable enough to spin up to ask that question, but then also to dynamically spin down as soon as you've gotten the answer, because you don't want and you definitely don't need all of that computing resource all the time. And so, as I said, the cloud infrastructure kind of paradigm that we find ourselves operating in today is perfectly positioned to help answer that. Unfortunately, the world isn't yet perfectly positioned to help answer that. I think, you know, a little over two years ago, we started the journey that's led us to this announcement of our intentions to build this planetary computer. And it started with launching a program called AI for Earth, this five-year, $50 million commitment to deploy machine learning in areas like biodiversity, water, agriculture, and climate change. But when we stepped back kind of at the two-year anniversary of that program and we said, you know, what's going well, what isn't going well, we are quite proud of many of the things that we've achieved, the work that we've empowered grantees to do. But it was really clear that we weren't allowing our grantees, or anyone else for that matter, to build on the work of each other, to take you know, data that was contributed by one organization and machine learning algorithms that were contributed by another, put those two together to create a new service that anybody could use, that anybody could access.
These were all like isolated pockets of information. I guess like the way the healthcare system works in the US, you have to go to, you have to bring your data from your old doctor to your new doctor or something, right?
That's a fantastic analogy. And it was one of those things, it was a really humbling kind of experience, right? To step back and do that kind of 2-year review, because we're in the tech sector. We're Microsoft. Right. If there's one word that we live and die by, it's scale. So I was very focused on and proud of the fact that each individual grantee was able to use our computing infrastructure to scale their own work. But it was humbling to look back and realize that actually what we were doing wasn't allowing us to scale all of that work all around the world. And that's really where this idea of a new kind of platform came from.
Gotcha. And can you talk about, I guess, how you guys are going to go about accomplishing this? Do we have the technology to start building out this idea of a planetary computer? Do we have the processing power, the ways to track this data in real time? Or are you betting on new technologies coming down the line the next 5 or 10 years to help this out?
I think it's a mix of both. The data that we have coming in every day from satellites around the world, from citizen scientists around the world, from field robotics like camera traps all around the world, we're already capable of doing amazing things with that if we allow it to all come together in a common ecosystem, a common computational ecosystem. It really just requires some significant focusing and prioritization of just building out what needs to get done. You know, if you just take that on the ground example, one of the projects that I've been so excited about inside Microsoft is a project called Project Premonition that's building new, entirely new field robotics to change the way that we collect biological information, putting robots out into the field that are able to listen and chemically smell and do all of these things to characterize the environment, including capturing insects and using real-time machine learning to understand what species those are, the densities that they exist in, and then transmitting that information all the way up to the cloud. All the way to very, you know, futuristic, but hopefully not too far out into the future, technologies like quantum computing. Because when we think about my ultimate question that I try to see us driving towards every day is thinking about what humanity's objective function should be for planet Earth. What do we want to achieve with all of our natural resources? And how can we do that in a way that optimally derives human benefit from natural resources while minimizing human negative impacts? And to do that, you are actually talking about the world's largest optimization experiment.
Right, right.
And we don't actually have the computing power. For instance, if you said every square meter of land and water on Earth in both X, Y, and Z dimensions, right, have some very large but finite number of utility functions, right? There's some sort of value from timber and from fiber and from crops and for, you know, on and on and on. And then you said, okay, what we want to do is we want to maximize, you know, environmental benefits, minimize the amount of land that we use, et cetera, and you tried to optimize for that. That's an extremely large optimization experiment.
Can you talk a little more about the idea of what a quantum computer could do for this? Because I feel like it's still a vague concept for most people, even though I've written about it quite a bit too. Like it's the idea of having a computer that is taking instructions and like processing things one at a time versus a computer that can actually see all this data and have a lot of requests happening all at once. It seems a little more like the way the world actually works, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been a lot of hype about quantum that it's going to solve all of our problems, right? I mean, yeah. I think what we should be thinking about quantum as is one tool in our computing toolbox that is sharper than any right. tool that we've ever, you know, that we've ever invented. And really one of the things that it's so perfectly poised to assist with is optimization. And current classical computing requires you to take a step, assess it against a globe, you know, what the ultimate outcome you're trying to achieve, take another step, assess it, and keep doing that. And then go back to the beginning and start over and do it another way. And then go back to the beginning. Quantum can just do it all at once, which is so hard for our brains.
Right.
I mean, the irony is it's so hard for our brains to understand, even though that's what our brains are probably doing at the quantum level at any particular time.
We deal with superstates every day, but we don't. It's hard to put it into words, I guess, or to like rationalize it. I'm wondering too, like, have you guys thought about if this thing actually gets going, especially if you're using, you know, powerful next generation quantum computers, is this optimization, do you think it could involve things that maybe are unpalatable to humans, like things we haven't thought of before or things that have been arguments before? I'm thinking of like here in New York, we're losing a nuclear reactor very soon because for a lot of reasons, people think nuclear power is bad. But it's going to be replaced with probably a gas plant, which is worse. So this sort of machine would be like, hey, maybe don't do that. Maybe it is better for us to like keep this nuclear around and just make sure it's safe. Are you guys prepared for those sorts of like maybe hard truths?
What people aren't very good at, and I don't mean any particular person, I mean the human species. What we're not very good at is multi-objective trade-off functions, right?
I like that term. Yeah.
The example that you just gave, well, I don't like necessarily the terms good and bad from a scientific perspective. Nothing's good or bad necessarily. They just are. But from a societal perspective, certain things can be good or bad depending on your belief system. And so, you know, some people would say certain aspects of nuclear are good and certain aspects of nuclear are bad, coal good or bad. And they're good and bad on different time periods as well.
Right, right. And
the way that we approach this at the intersection of governance, societal demand, and technology is extremely suboptimal right now. Because we don't necessarily even ever step back and ask what our objective function actually is. We just say, oh, that's bad, so we'll do something else. And, you know, and then somebody says, but that'll be worse. And then we get into this,
right,
you know, ad nauseum argument. The position I would like to get our species into is one that puts us back in the driver's seat of what we are uniquely capable of doing, which is using what evolution has provided us from our mental capacity to ask questions about what we want as a society, as an individual, as a society. What do we want? And that's your objective function, right? Right. Math, we can use math to take that emotion, that human desire, and take that from an oral narrative or a mental narrative and codify it in a numerical system that can then be integrated with a computational system that then can tell us how to achieve what we want most optimally. And where we're suboptimally using our resources is trying to figure out how to do it. Right.
Right. And also these emotions and all these things, too. It seems like we have a lot of data in the world, but humans are very bad at that, at least just especially seeing what's happening around America these days, too. It's tough.
Yeah, exactly right. And so you know, your particular question is, are you prepared for those hard truths? I'm prepared for getting to the outcome we want.
Right.
One of the things that I deal with a lot, just given, you know, my field and the sector I'm in is, you know, concerns around AI and you know, taking away autonomy from people. And I would actually argue it's exactly the opposite, in that we're using our brains and our capabilities suboptimally because we're spending so much time putting them to work at things that they, you know, they just really aren't that good at. And if we would be significantly better off by by taking that creativity, that ingenuity, that kind of societal discourse that we're capable of, and the governance functions that we put in place, and asking those big societal questions, and let technology do the hard work, right? I don't ask how my email opens or how it got sent, mm-hmm. right? Like, I just want to understand the content, the objective, the message that I was trying to deliver, the outcome that I was trying to deliver. And I think that is the more that we can think about how technology can lift us up as a species and put us back at kind of on top of the pedestal, I think mm-hmm. the better off we'll be.
Love that explanation. I'm just wondering too, for my final question, it seems like Microsoft is doing a lot to kind of further its environmental goals and, you know, kind of just think about its impact on the planet. What responsibility do you think tech companies have towards thinking about these things for the future? Because tech is, it's the biggest success, you know, in the world. These are the biggest businesses. You guys have the most modern tools. How should tech be thinking about these problems in general?
You know, a company like Microsoft, we're at a level that really means that, you know, comments like our CEO Satya Nadella made a few weeks ago ring so true when he said, for Microsoft to do well, the world needs to do well.
Mm-hmm.
The argument about why should we, you know, yeah, it's nice to do nice things, you know, in the private sector, but that's not core to our, you know, to our business. When you're at the level of Microsoft, keeping the world doing well is paramount for you to do well. And so the sustainability work that I lead is perfectly aligned with the profit-driven business that we lead more generally. And so I don't necessarily, you know, see the fact that we have a responsibility, like it's some sort of extracurricular sort of thing, that it's our responsibility right, right. to be a good corporate citizen. It's our mm-hmm. responsibility to the make the world a better place so that Microsoft can have a better place to operate and be a better company.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Excellent. Well, I'm looking forward to following, you know, all of your work and everything you guys are doing. Good luck with this. It sounds like a major initiative, and yeah, it sounds like the sort of thing we actually do need. So my main takeaway from our chat is that it's a really interesting idea that Microsoft is thinking more broadly than we've heard from a lot of other companies about mm-hmm. their impact on the world and how they can make the world a better overall place. It's sort of like moral philosophy applied to a giant corporation. You know, let's make the world better, therefore our business could be better, rather than just making, hey, Amazon wants to make their shipping better. Amazon wants to make certain components of their business better.
Right.
I find that really interesting. How does this compare to other things you've heard, Sherlyn?
I mean, look, we've heard of a lot of initiatives on similar fronts to this. I think that Microsoft certainly has the, you know, Azure is such a huge network and such mm-hmm. a huge product that's so deeply steeped in machine learning and AI that Microsoft really has the chops to do this. Google is another company that has a lot of AI chops and also launched an AI for social good campaign. Mm-hmm.
Which sounds like Microsoft's, yeah, that sounds like Microsoft's first, you know, initiative too. Like it's right. very similar, but I haven't heard of anything as expansive as this idea of a planetary computer. But again,
yeah.
it's all kind of out
so
there.
So
yeah.
I think that what you were saying at first is that planetary computer is kind of a misnomer, right? Like you're mm-hmm. not talking about one computer that has the power of the planet or all of the properties right. of the planet in it. It's basically a central database for all the properties and the information that people should know at any given time mm-hmm. as to their impact on the environment.
Yeah, but so, all like, in real time, all real, yeah. like the idea of real time monitoring of the weather and individual things happening all across the planet all at once
yeah.
is pretty
it's,
wild. Yeah.
It's super cool because like I just want to break it down super simple. And mm-hmm. like the example he gave of, say, a robot going into a farm, picking up an insect and immediately kind of using machine learning to understand the population density maybe of that insect in that given patch of space. Mm-hmm. And then knowing all the other correlating information about that plot, like the weather patterns, like the nutrients in the soil and how all of that will affect that particular species of insects, like growth rate in that area, and in, you know, historical change in mm-hmm. populations, maybe. That's just nuts. That's like the I mean, we're imagining very far ahead in the future. So like, to have the processing power to be able to like churn out that information in maybe a minute to immediately give you a chart that plots all of that in relation to mm-hmm. all of the other things you want.
I wouldn't even think a minute. Like, there, the vision he's saying.
I mean, obviously, like faster. Yeah.
By real time, I think they mean like real time.
I know. You know? Like, I'm just being cautious.
Instantly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But yeah, this will certainly
take 5G
a lot.
5G ain't even here yet.
Oh yeah, and we will need 5G and good like satellite uplink and everything for all
exactly.
this. Certainly the cost of something like this is astounding. Like, we talked about kind of, do we have the tech for this right now? In certain respects, it sounds like we do.
We have the beginnings of it. We have 5G starting to roll out. I mean, you're not going to get 5G in a farm for another 2 years or so, right? And then, SpaceX just launched a bunch of satellites for their internet satellite mm-hmm. system. So, you know, good for them. Yeah. But we're a ways out. But yeah, okay, to your point, if we project super far into the future where all the tech is available, sure, real time. I mean, that's still fascinating.
Well,
that's
also fascinating. And the thing that we don't really talk about that often is quantum computing and how that'll change the way we work. And this is why I keep bringing up the TV show Devs on Hulu, because I thought it was a really fun exploration of quantum computing. But yeah, we really don't know. Like, what happens right now, we're thinking of computers where like, oh, I'm looking for this data. Computer, fetch me this data. But a quantum computer can work in the way, like, the way we know physics works, which is sort of like interpreting several possibilities all at once. There's some like Terminator aspect to what he's saying, like this giant, you know, AI powered machine that'll tell us the best way to live. I'm glad I got to ask a question about nuclear in there, because that is a problem we're facing in New York and nobody is talking about it, which is kind of wild to me. But
His answer was pretty much what I expected also. Just be like, from the perspectives of science, nothing is inherently good or bad, but he can spit you out the possible scenarios if you do shut down or if you don't shut down this nuclear reactor, and then tell you what the outcome is, and you decide as the human being, which is pretty interesting.
Pretty good. Well, yeah, what if the machine is like, hey, humans, you're bad. Maybe just go away for now. Like, that would be best for the planet. But anyway, let's talk about how this compares to other plans. So you mentioned Google's AI Impact Challenge, and it was very like limited. They were talking about like forecasting floods and mapping global fishing activity and health trends.
I'll say that that's kind of what Google already is able to actively start working on, like the using AI to forecast floods, like you said, mapping global fishing activity, predicting cardiac arrest, all the typical stuff that we've seen a lot of scientists put AI to work on. But the AI Impact Challenge is a little bit different. It's where Google sources ideas from around the world, and they got actually about 2,600 proposals in 2018 from like six continents and stuff like that. And the results from the report that I read that Google published about their findings there was that, there's a lot of people really earnestly looking into this, but AI might not be the answer to everything is one of the findings. And that a lot of companies, while they want to use AI for responsibility, they don't really know how to. And I think that that's a big question. I think that that's what this planetary computer idea is a good first step towards. I'm still a little nervous about the idea of a central computer having all the data about the world.
You know, we need more information. It is astounding, like the little information we have about certain things, how little we know about like the deep sea. You know, I feel like having more data would help us better understand how we're, you know, affecting the planet. And I think that would be an important thing eventually.
I'm a little curious too, or maybe I want to maybe get them to clarify, is that this is all about the Earth. It's not about your financial data. It's not about centralizing what, you know, the federal government already knows about you. This is centralizing information about the environment, ecological impact and stuff like that. So not, I mean, because I started thinking that way. I was like, why isn't there a central banking system? Why isn't there, like, I don't know.
Well, I started thinking in terms of like spy stuff. Because we started aerial photography because war, you know, because we needed intelligence
spying
from our enemies. So that's also what pushed satellites out there. And that was like the great thrust of the Cold War. So I do wonder how something like this could be abused, like any technology we talk about. I think some of it could be really cool, really innovative. How can it be abused by bad actors and certainly by governments who could push Microsoft to do things with this data that, you know, hey, the U.S. wants to be the only one who knows specific, you know, mining data or something like that.
Yeah. And it really can't be Microsoft that owns all of this data. I think that it needs to be opened up to everyone to use. Amazon. I mean, Google should be able to use that information, use their AI to run an API and something.
They own GitHub now. Like this would be, this could be and should be like the world's biggest open source project. Like all of humanity coming together to use this data. Yeah. For better. So let me bring up a couple other companies here. Amazon. Mm-hmm. I think is an example of one of those companies that really is talking about how they can make their own business better. So they have said,
all about me.
Yeah, all about me, which is it's fine because they have a huge environmental impact. Yeah. They said AWS surpassed 50% renewable energy in 2018, which is pretty huge.
Okay,
they
launched
three new wind farms last year. They have some solar farms already. I think this is something that is worth noting. Running these data centers, as bad as they can be, because we know a lot of these data centers can be huge, like they're already huge power sinks.
Yep,
they represent a major chunk of the power we use globally.
Yeah.
But having these things is much more efficient than a company running its own servers and managing its own equipment because you're only really using what you need. And as a former IT guy who had to like dive into servers and deal with like a lot of wiring and stuff and watch machines sit idle because it wasn't being used enough, like this is a better outcome than where we were before. But because we rely so much on computing, it's going to take up a lot of power. That's kind of how it goes. So let me just drop a couple other numbers here for you. Amazon says that they're aiming for 100% renewables by 2030, 80% by 2024. They estimated they reached 40% last year. This is for the entire company. So that's pretty impressive. And they're aiming for 50% shipment net zero carbon by 2030. So I think some of that's going to be involving like carbon offsets and other things. But still a big deal, although their shipment keeps growing too. So it's like their impact will continue to grow over time.
Yeah.
They did announce a $100 million climate fund to restore environments, which is sort of like you look at Amazon's business and how much money they have.
Right.
$100 million to help.
Nothing.
In general is not. It's not really much. I don't want to sound ungrateful here, but I'm just saying in the grand scale of things, like how much Amazon does, how little taxes they pay to the U.S. It feels like one of those things that companies do just for the credit of seeming kind-hearted.
Right.
But yeah, tough to say. And Facebook, by the way, has said they're committed to reducing their greenhouse gas footprint by 75% and reaching 100% renewable energy in 2020. So that's a pretty, you know, that's happening
this
right
year.
Now.
Yeah.
But that's their aim. We don't know how far along, you know, they've actually come.
This week, Google also announced that it will be, on its data centers, it will be relegating the less urgent tasks to times of day when wind and solar energy are more available. So only crucial tasks like processing maps requests that happen all the time and people really need their directions in real time, those sorts of things are happening any time of day and on all whatever energy they can get at that time. But less important tasks like photos processing or like face recognition in your photos, those things will be only taking place at the data centers when they have abundance of wind energy, for example. So I think that that's a good thing. Data centers, like we said, really, really suck up a shit ton of energy.
Yeah.
Can I say shit?
Yes, yes you can. Because it's a shit ton.
You know what? Shit is a source of energy. Let's just put that out there. But
in many countries, yes.
It is in many. That is a good, I think, move on Google's part. We learned that the infotech industry could consume about 20% of all electricity generated. And it gives out 5.5% of the world's carbon by 2025. So that's a report published in The Guardian.
Of just data centers, which is just data centers. Astounding. Yeah.
And there is about roughly 8 million data centers worldwide, according to an IDC count. And so the power used by data centers right now apparently doubles every 4 years. So, wow. Wow, wow, wow.
I do feel like things like the whole digital currency rush, mm-hmm. that stuff involved so God. Much power.
The Bitcoin mining, you mean? Yeah. Yeah, holy
Bitcoin
crap.
Mining, all that. But it involves so much power for, yeah. for nothing. For yeah. like, you know, fake digital for, money
exactly.
that, you know, some people could really bank on rather than cash.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna complain about that too much, but I just think the resources involved are bad. So if we were actually spending that data center, you know, energy on things we actually need and something yeah. like the idea of a planetary computer, I think that yeah. would be a lot more palatable. Yeah.
Right. And I was going to say that, like, it's, you know, what we were saying about the planetary computer, that's going to drain a lot of energy because that quantum computing that needs mm-hmm. to happen to deliver results in real time. Is
well, we don't know if it'll be quantum computing, but yeah, quantum, if we do get an effective quantum computer, because right now we're building these giant complex things that can't really process that much. It's just yeah. like theoretical quantum computing processing. We've written stuff about that. Go look mm-hmm. at like the rise, like how quantum computers are racing like qubits, mm-hmm. the amount of like quantum processing they can do. It's a very slow and steady race right now. But yeah, if we ever get to that point, it'll be just like the incredible TV show Devs, where you will just have this giant.
You just
like
that show because it's like part of your name. Stop it.
No, Sherlyn, that would be your thing.
Devs
that
more would, like Devendra.
That would be more your thing, but you should also watch that show, Sherlyn.
I've been
it'll blow
watching
you
it.
Away.
I've yeah. been watching it. It's fine. I mean, look,
it's no insert bad Sherlyn TV show. Here.
Wow, wow, it's no The Strain.
Yeah, it's no The Strain. God,
the planetary computer thing. I think that yes, there's a potential for it to run up a lot of energy consumption, but on the flip side, we could also use the data we get to yeah. figure out how to optimize our energy consumption and make it all cleaner and greener. I will say you mentioned earlier that you know used to be an IT mm-hmm. worker. I don't know what your title was. Administrator, okay. And looked at servers.
Okay.
But my old job was to work on, I worked in oil and gas, honestly, mm-hmm. as a marketing executive. And this was way back in Singapore in like mid-2000s. And we were pivoting to green energy. We were pivoting the same equipment that could be used for making a jack-up rig is the same equipment you would use to build a wind turbine. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense across the board. It just makes sense to switch to green energy. And
it makes
was like
sense, yeah. We are
nice
still waiting for good battery tech to really make that accurate. Good, yeah. That's a whole other episode of like where are the good batteries? What is happening with batteries? It yeah. is that's really our future. But yeah. Anyway, any further thoughts, Sherlyn? Any further fears? Like, I do wonder what it'll be like when we do have a planet-wide, you know, database that's powered by Microsoft in basically
Windows.
It sounds
like science fiction. It sounds like science fiction. I think this is a good idea in theory. I think mm-hmm. I was about to shout out and say that we need good regulation then when we're going to do this stuff. But I yep. also don't know that I trust regulation to come through well yet. Mm-hmm. There's not enough people knowledgeable about this stuff in politics to really come up with a good way to manage all of this.
I mean, yeah, we definitely don't know. All of this stuff is a leap of faith. I would much rather have more leaps of faith like this of companies trying to do more good in the world, just trying to be a little more I don't know, sensitive about their impact and how they coexist with everybody else. And that's something I think Microsoft has done really well since Satya Nadella came on as CEO. He's really transformed that company. I've written about it quite a bit in Engadget 2. Like, they're focused on Windows. They're focusing more on like things users actually want rather mm-hmm. than forcing technologies and things that Microsoft wants you to have. So I think it's a big shift for the company overall. I hope this whole thing works out, and I hope other companies look at yes. this and be like, maybe either we could help or we could do something that's on the same level. I want some competition here. I think that would be better for the planet as a whole.
I want an Avengers of the tech companies. I want Google, Amazon, Facebook, Microsoft all to work together to make this happen.
Good luck with that. But yes, that would be interesting to see. Let's move on to what we're working on. I have yet another gaming laptop. They just never end. It's basically gaming laptop season because Intel and NVIDIA and AMD, they've all made big news recently with their chips. So I'm looking at MSI's new GS66. Stealth. This is a sort of the sequel to the GS65 Stealth Thin I reviewed about 2 years ago. It is super thin, pretty light for a 15-inch machine, but what's really impressive, it has a ton of power, has an RTX 2070 GPU, and it has a 300 hertz screen.
Oh, wow.
300 hertz. We're talking about 90 hertz phones, 120 hertz phones.
We've seen 144 hertz on laptops, too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, 144, that was like the main gaming thing like several years ago. Then they jumped to 200, 240.
Yeah.
And now we've reached 300 hertz, which is overkill.
Nuts.
Certainly, like, your eyes won't see it. But all that means is that your gameplay, as you get closer to 300 FPS... So you wouldn't be doing that in maybe a really modern game like Destiny 2 and this hardware, but maybe something like Overwatch or CSGO, competitive games, it will just look a lot smoother. It has pretty much everything you want. It looks and feels great. Based on my testing so far, that Asus Zephyrus G14 I reviewed a couple weeks ago is still like the killer deal of gaming right now, because that processor is so good and the GPU is so good and the price, like, you could get a sick machine for around $1,400. I'm still like, that's the one I'd recommend to most people. But if you're looking for something a little more polished, this, I loved MSI's machines in general. This one is as slick and powerful and a little more higher quality than that Asus. So it's something to look out for. My review should be going up next week, so keep an eye out for that. Sherlyn, what's up with you?
I, first of all, can't wait for that MSI machine to crap out 20 minutes into your game because it's running at 300 hertz. But we will see your battery life test results.
This
but
is
anyhow,
not a battery life machine. That Asus is a good battery life machine, but not this. Yeah.
So that VR exercise app that I've been talking up for 2 weeks now is finally live. My story is up. It's called Supernatural. And with a name like that, you would think it's got ghosts, but it doesn't, unfortunately and disappointingly. It's actually called Supernatural because basically it's set in these really gorgeous environments. Have you played Beat Saber, Dev? You probably have.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Beat Saber is this like DDR-ish game, except for it's in VR using the Oculus controllers as lightsaber-ish sticks where you whack things away in, you know, according to the instructions flying at you. And this is very similar. Supernatural is a workout app. You are supposed to smash these balls that are flying at you with the corresponding stick and blast them into smithereens. And then when a triangle flies towards you, you have to squat to fit in that triangle. So what ended up happening is that I was, you know, you had to whack it with a certain amount of force for it to actually like smash or it will just bounce away. So it's a workout. It's a full workout. It's a whole body workout. You're slowly turning around in space to
Sweaty are you getting in that VR headset?
Dude,
I get sweaty in VR headsets just by wearing them, even without the workout.
They had to send like 20 disinfecting wipes along with it with the Oculus Quest they loaned me, as well as a sweat mask. They sent a sweat mask.
So, you need a sweat mask.
You also saw, I think, Dev, you might have seen me appear right after a VR workout on a call where my face was like fully red and there were marks on my face from all of that abrasion. But it's a workout, man. Like, honestly, the headline of my piece is a VR workout app killed my quads.
I saw. Yeah,
good lord. I tried that out on Monday. Tuesday I just couldn't walk. Wednesday I couldn't squat, and today is Thursday and I still can't use my legs. Like, this is bad.
Cool. That's cool. It sounds cool. The only thing is, like, the price of VR entry, is it comfortable for you to do this stuff for a very long time? Yeah.
It is comfortable when I do just a 15-minute workout and all of my workouts about that long. But I will say that, like, you need the Quest. It doesn't work on any other headset right now. But fair enough. And
because it has to be wireless. You have to move. Yeah,
right.
I assume.
Exactly. And so it's a $600 headset. Plus, after a 30-day trial that's free, you need to pay $20 a month to use this thing. So I wouldn't do it because I don't have the Oculus Quest, you know, and
that's like a Peloton level subscription.
Peloton's like $40 a month, but still,
It's one of those things where you have this hardware, you buy the software, right? It's also software you have to buy.
Yeah.
And then the monthly fee.
The app itself is free, and then you pay the monthly subscription for the workouts. I just think that, I mean, again, go read the article for my deep impressions for all my pain. I'm still working on a bunch of other reviews that I can't really talk about, but it is review season I'm reviewing things ranging from laptops to phones to maybe wearables. I can't tell y'all until next time. So stay tuned. We're just working hard here.
Very cool. I hope you can get access to a Ring Fit eventually and see how that works in your Switch, because I feel like that to me is the best example of balancing, you know, virtual interactivity and not having to wear a freaking mask on your face while you're sweating.
I took a video of myself working out and I look ridiculous. If y'all send us a nice review or a nice email, I might send you a screenshot from that video.
All right, let's move on to our picks. My pick for this week is Cursed Films. On Shudder. It's a new series that is all about horror movies and other movies, but also movies in general that have maybe a curse attached to them. And I'm thinking of like the Lee family curse and what that meant for The Crow. I'm thinking of what happened in the Twilight Zone movie, which is heartbreaking and depressing. There's curses attached to Poltergeist. It's using curse in a very broad way, but really it's a way to explore these movies, this like quote-unquote cursed impact, the impact of their curses, and kind of how interesting that is, and looking at the impact of these movies over time. It's all really interesting. Poltergeist had it quite a bit because there's the whole thing about them using, you know, real skeletons in the pool sequence, which they give it a good reason for why that would be the case, because it's easier to have a real, you know, alone medical skeleton or something than like to build your own. But things like that, I find it really interesting. I like Shudder in general. I just started subscribing to Shudder. I love horror movies. They have a good selection and some good original stuff too, so it's probably a service I'll stick with for a while. But this is a show I really enjoy seeing, and also it's funny because I know, you know, some of the people who are being interviewed on it, so it's always fun to see people I've talked to on my podcast, on my TV. So weird. So weird. But Sherlyn, what is up with you?
So I'm going to run really quickly through what I've been doing and then go into my recommendation. I have been watching The Strain, but it's getting crap in the second season, so I'm not into it.
Is it getting crap? Yeah.
It's pretty crap. And then the I've been then also in tandem watching Penny Dreadful on Netflix, which is...
That's a good show.
It's really good.
That is a good show.
I know. Sherlyn. Aren't you proud of me? I really like it.
I am. I'm giving my hat to you.
Thank you.
I do. I remember I fell off in like season two where things got a little wonky, but I think the first season of Penny Dreadful with like Eva Green, and
I love it.
She is amazing, but also like,
great.
It has such great twists on like the original monster formula. Like I love the way they handle Frankenstein's monster.
Yeah.
It is astounding.
Well, there's that's because really also like there. I recently rewatched League of Extraordinary Gentlemen because it was on Hulu.
There we go. That's what I was waiting for.
But this is basically that, but you know, more better thought out. And
yes, it is. Yeah, it is.
And it's a TV show. So anyhow, I've been watching these two and I've been playing a little bit more of League of Legends. I used to play way back when, and recently, because I've been testing a laptop, I just decided, heck, I'll run a League of Legends test, and I just got sucked in and I've been getting really good. And so you might see me playing this soon.
Yeah, how good?
It means I've been good, meaning I've been like level 18, 21. I pentakilled, all right? Like, let's just say I aced an entire enemy team. Let's just do that.
And I don't know what any of this means. What league are you in?
I'm in a beginner league. I'm not in any leagues. I'm still playing bots. Beginner bots. So that's how good I am. Anyhow, but my actual film recommendations, because let's continue in the thread of Asian horror that I've been trying to do. I'd like to recommend Rule Number One. I don't know if you've heard of it, Dev.
No,
it's a Hong Kong film. It's really intriguing. It features a lot of big name stars. We've got Eakin Cheng and Sean Yue. These are like big names out of Hong Kong. And a Singaporean actress has a bit part in it. And it's about this department of the police in Hong Kong where they investigate just supernatural cases. But there is a rule that you can't let a haunted person touch you or something happens. And so mm-hmm. it kind of like just that's why the title is Rule Number One. But I like the storytelling in it. I forget who directs it. I'm sorry. But I like it a lot. It's if you can find it, I'm pretty sure it's on something somewhere. if you're sick of horror film recommendations, though, yeah. I have another film recommendation really quick. It's called in Chinese, it's called Feng Sheng. The English title is The Message. And it's a Chinese film. It's out of China about around the Second World War, where a group of Chinese nationals have been rounded up into this house because mm-hmm. they're suspected of being rebellions against the Japanese regime. They're all like working for the Japanese like in place government, but they're suspected of feeding army information to the Chinese rebellion, and they're trying to find out who the spy is. So it's kind of like Clue, mm-hmm. but you're finding the spy, and it gets a little gory at parts because the torture scenes are pretty bad, but the mystery and the way it unfolds and the way the story is told is just so interesting. It grabs you from the beginning. It's just wild. I love it. I loved it. So if you don't want horror, go for some torture porn, you know?
Wow. Your tastes are very,
very weird. You can tell where my head's at. And that's it for the episode this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Twitter, and find me talking about better movies at the /filmcast@slashfilm.com.
Well, if you want to recommend me some upbeat, positive movies that I will never watch, I'm at Sherlyn Lowe on Twitter. Email us at podcast@engadget.com, leave us a review on iTunes, and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify.